Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Positive Education Podcast. My name is Ash Manuel. And before I introduce today's guest, I just want to ask one quick favor. If you could go over to the platform that you're listening to this podcast on and give us a five-star review, particularly if you feel the podcast is helpful and you're taking lots of actionable ideas away, because what that does is it'll help us reach a lot more people and hopefully have a positive impact on more people. Now, we're going to get straight into today's episode. So, today's guest is Dr. Mark Williams. Now, Mark is an internationally renowned neuroscientist with over 25 years' experience conducting behavioral and brain imaging research, focusing on our social skills. He's an award-winning neuroscientist, as I mentioned, internationally renowned, over 70 scientific articles published, which is amazing. So, I really wanted to get Mark on today to talk about how we best learn, and particularly how young people best learn. We also talk about with technology and AI, how that is impacting on young people's learning. Also, Mark's got a really interesting story. We start off with this about how he almost ended up in jail, and now he's become a world-renowned scientist. So, that's a very interesting story as well. Now, I'm really excited for this episode because I'm always interested in how we best learn. And I think one of the things that maybe when I was younger, I often reflect about this and still often do as an adult, how do we best learn? Like, how do we teach young people to think? How do we teach the best way to grasp concepts and things like this? Because I always wonder, like, particularly if we're having a bad day, how can we think to work through those challenging times as well? So we dive into that and we talk to Mark about that. It's a really interesting episode. Highly recommend listening to the entire episode. So many takeaways that you can apply. So without further ado, we'll get into the episode. Dr. Mark Williams, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Ash.
Pleasure, mate. And I'm really been really keen to have you on after a few recommendations, and I'm keen to talk about the science of learning today. But first of all, you got a very interesting story. I think it's very interesting anyway, with a bit of a backstory where you say that you nearly went to jail. And now, obviously, you're a world-renowned neuroscientist. How did that come about?
I grew up in a small country town, and my mother had mental health issues. Turns out my father did too, but we didn't realize that until much later on. And I hated school. Back then there was corporal punishment at school, so you get the strap or the cane if you were one of the bad kids. And I was one of the bad kids, so we used to avoid that by going down the lake and fishing and smoking pot most of the time. I wasn't academic at all. I didn't think I was very smart. My high school principal told me when I was about 15 that I'd be dead or in prison by the time I was 25, and that I should go and get a apprenticeship at the local abattoir because he basically wanted to get rid of me and get rid
That's
of
encouraging, isn't
it. It is very encouraging. It wasn't until I was 25 that two of my friends had drug overdoses, and I decided to do, I needed to change something. So I went back to TAFE and to do my HSC. I didn't really know what I was going to do after that. And there was a physics teacher there that connected with me, and we actually bonded over our records. We both collected records. Back then, everyone had records. CDs just sort of started coming. And yeah, he convinced me that I was smarter than I'd ever thought I was, and that I should apply to go to university. So I did. I applied to do a Bachelor of Science. And of course, when you do a general degree like a Bachelor of Science, you get to choose what subjects you do. You've got to do four different subjects in the first year, and two of those I decided to do psychology and physiology. I did psychology because I wanted to learn about why I was so screwed up and why basically, yeah, my family was so screwed up, like parents and so on. And I did physiology, which was biology to begin with, and then it moves into physiology because I was always really interested in just how we work, what we are as humans. And I just fell in love with it. So I ended up doing double major in physiology and in psychology, and then doing a PhD in medicine, and then I was worked at Melbourne University for a little while, and then I was lucky enough to get a fellowship to go over to MIT in the US and work, which was an amazing place to work. And it was an amazing time to be there.
God, that's a great story. Can I just ask, when you mentioned that a couple of friends had drug overdoses and you realised, well, that's maybe not the path I want to go down. What made you that decision to go to TAFE and I guess maybe change your lifestyle to maybe go on to achieve what, or in the end you've achieved a lot, but what made that decision, or what led to that decision at the time, do you think?
Back then, they brought in that if you're on the dole, you either had to be looking for work or you had to be doing a degree. So I went, all right, I'll go and do a degree, and went back to HSC and did my HSC. To be honest, it wasn't really anything profound. It was that, and I just wanted a change. I was with the same group of people and we were all doing a lot of drugs and we were all partying pretty hard, and you know, it was fun, but I was getting to that age where you sort of go, where does this go? And I'd always thought, because of what my principal said and because of everything that was going on in my life, I'd always thought that I'd be dead by the time I was 25. So I sort of hit 25 and went, oh, I'm not, now what am I gonna do? So yeah, it was an opportunity to go to do something different, and to learn, and that was an amazing.
Yeah, and it sounds like it took one person to believe in you, really, didn't it? Like, by the sound of it, to give you that belief that you could go on.
Yeah, I mean, there was hiccups. I actually, when I finished doing that, I actually first enrolled, which I don't usually talk about, but I first enrolled in Sydney University in Bachelor of Science, and I only lasted about 6 months because, you know, everyone around me was still doing the same things, and so I went back into the same stuff, and then I ended up moving back down to Melbourne, and I enrolled in Monash, and luckily Monash let me in. And then all of a sudden I wasn't around the same people anymore. So all of a sudden I could really reset and change what was going on. And I think that's one thing that we don't realize about addiction is most people, it's really hard to cure addiction, because whether it's drug addiction or alcohol addiction or we have gaming addiction, a sex addiction, whatever it happens to be, it's not actually the addiction that's the hardest thing to get rid of. It's actually the cues that actually trigger that behavior. It's actually what's where you are in your environment, which is why, you know, about 90% of people who go into rehab to cure themselves of any of these addictions, they then get back, like they're cured, right? And that's, then they get all the therapy and everything, but then they go back to where they were before, where they were living before, and all the cues are still there. And so once they get cued again, they actually go straight back into it, which is why we don't have very good success rate with addiction at all, because those cues that actually trigger our behavior rather than just the behavior itself. You've got to get rid of the cue.
That's interesting. I didn't really think of that, but that makes a lot of sense that you say that. And that's pretty good self-awareness by yourself to understand that, being in that environment in Sydney, and then actually having that, I guess, taking that ownership to leave that degree and then reset in Melbourne. Well, that takes a fair bit of self-awareness, a bit of courage to do.
Yeah. Again, it wasn't really me, to be honest. I got pretty sick and had change things. But I really did hit a wall and went, I've got to change. Yeah. I moved back to my parents' place for 6 months, and then I moved back down to Melbourne. So yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, I'd love to say it was all me, but it wasn't. But again, that's humans, right?
Yeah.
Most people, it's because of people in their lives that they actually go on and do amazing things. It's not because of them, and it doesn't matter who you talk to. But amazing sports people, you know, it's their parents who drive them at 4 o'clock in the morning to training, and drive them to competitions, and drive them to, right? It's then, and they're having amazing coaches that keep, you know, supporting them, and support them when they have injuries, and support them when they go through. I think everything in our life, none of us become amazing people or do amazing things because of just us. It's always a huge number of people around you that actually support you or trigger those behaviors and help that to happen.
Yep. Yeah, I understand. And thanks for sharing that story. That's pretty amazing journey that you've been on. And 25 years or over 25 years later, here we are today, and I'm sure you've got a lot of knowledge to share, and I'd love to jump into a few things. Now, one thing I'm really interested in, particularly, I guess, for like teaching young people, as this podcast focuses on normally, generally for teachers. So teaching like the brain, not just the student. So with, what do I mean by that is, or can you explain what that term means? I've come across that term, tongue twisted there, but that term before about teaching the brain, not just the student, and I guess like connection before curriculum. Can you just explain those philosophies?
Yeah, so I mean, we've got to go back to how the brain actually works. And what astounds me is that teachers don't learn neuroscience, because that's what they're doing, right? Is they're actually doing neuroscience, and they're actually changing the brains of these students. And that's how learning happens. And so we've got to really understand how the brain does that, right, to actually then utilize that in the classroom, or, you know, when we're actually teaching. And what we've got to one of the things we've got to remember is that the brain, our brains, are exactly the same as they were 10,000 years ago, right? They haven't changed in the last 10,000 years, except for the fact they got a little bit smaller, which is a little ironic, to be honest. But they haven't changed in the last 10,000 years. And for the vast majority of that time, we've been hunter-gatherers, right? We've been working about 3 to 4 hours a day, and then the rest of the time we've been hanging out with each other and teaching each other and or socializing with each other and supporting each other and protecting each other. And so that's really how our brains have evolved. And the most important aspect to that is that we're constantly looking for who's in our in-group and who's not in our in-group. And we learn from people who are in our in-group really, really easily, because we do learn really easily. We as humans are amazing compared to computers. We can learn things with two trials, right? You take a toddler, for example. When a toddler is first learning about the world, their carer looks at a dog and says, dog, the toddler automatically, because they're connected with the carer, understands that the carer is looking at the dog, which is amazing anyway, the eye gaze and all those sorts of things, which is amazing when you think about that concept. But also, the toddler comes up with two hypotheses. One is that that dog is an item, that's its name, or that dog, the term dog, is for a whole category of these things, and I'll see lots of them in the future. And then the next time the carer sees a dog and says dog, the toddler automatically goes, oh, it's not an item, there's more than one of them, so it's a whole category of things, I'm going to see lots more of these in the future. Right, that's two trial learning, which is amazing. To do the same thing with artificial intelligence or with a computer, you'd have to input about 100,000 pictures of dogs and 100,000 pictures of cats, and then all it could do is tell the difference between dogs and cats. It couldn't actually pick out dogs just randomly, which is amazing, right? But you've got to be connected. The toddler has to be connected with the carer to actually learn that. Because if it was a stranger who said dog, they'd ignore it because they wouldn't be interested in it, because it's not someone they're actually connected with.
Yep.
And so we've got to connect with the students before we can actually teach them, because we know that connection is essential, because our brains are constantly looking for who can I trust. And the people I trust are the people that I'm going to learn from. And if I don't trust them, if they're not in my in-group, if they're not someone I like, then I'm not going to actually learn from them. And there's a huge amount of research now showing that that actually happens. There was a great study recently where they put EEG caps on all the students and the teacher when the teacher started teaching. And before they did the recordings, they actually did a little questionnaire with the students to ascertain which of the students actually liked the teacher and which of the students didn't like the teacher, which was connected to the teacher and which weren't. And then they looked at the oscillation. So our brains oscillate at different frequencies, and then the alpha, beta, gamma, theta, and they indicate different things. Alpha, you know, suggests that you're in a calm state and you're going, you know, an indication that you're ready to learn and so on. And they looked at what happened when the teacher stood up and started teaching. And when the teacher stood up and started teaching, the students who were connected with the teacher, who liked the teacher, their brain started oscillating synchronously with the teacher. The teacher's brain and their brain started oscillating together. And the students who weren't connected with the teacher, they stayed asynchronous. Then they looked at what the students actually learned. And they showed that when the students' brains were synchronous with the teacher, they actually learned the information the teacher was teaching. And when they were asynchronous, they didn't learn the information. So you've actually got to sync up with your students by connecting with them first before they'll actually learn from you. which takes a little bit of time and a little bit of actual, well, with some students are really easy, right? We all know that. Some students just want to learn. You walk into the classroom, they want it, yeah. Whereas other students, you've got to take time and you've got to actually, try and make that connection first so that then they want to actually learn from you. And it's so important for us. But the other thing, of course, is also realizing how the brain actually learns, you know, that we've got a working memory, which is a really limited capacity, and information has to go into that working memory or your consciousness first. And then it goes into a temporary store, and then at nighttime, it actually gets laid down in your long-term memory. And so, you know, when teaching, we've got to be really aware of things that distract kids in the classroom. For example, devices are really distracting, which is why you learn about 30% less when you're on a device compared when you're actually learning from a real person. Mm. Because again, we're the connected species, right? Where I actually want to learn from people. We don't want to learn from devices. And we know that you learn far less if you're actually learning from a device or learning from AI or learning from a robot than you do if you're actually learning from a human, which is why teachers will never lose their jobs, because we're always going to need them. Yeah. Because they're always, we're always going to be humans and we're always going to want to learn from humans.
Mm, that's so interesting. So that study is incredible. It's called ESG, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I actually had a meeting, this is going back years ago, with a neuroscientist, and it never happened, but I was so interested in hooking students up to these and just seeing their, like, how their brain, particularly around the gratitude side of things, like, does that increase their happiness and just things like that. But that's such a great example in a slightly different context of how having that connection with a teacher does increase learning, and which is amazing. Can I just ask, Mark, with that connection, what's some strategies that we can connect with young people better in our classrooms?
Yeah, the first thing when I present it at schools, the principal usually falls off his seat when I say this, but I'll say it anyway. And I always say it anyway. But the first thing teachers need to do is they need to touch their students more often. And we don't touch students enough. And the reason we need to touch them appropriately and with consent, of course, yep. But we need to touch them more because we have what we call C fibers in our skin, and C fibers only activate to touch. And when they're activated, they release oxytocin in our brain, and oxytocin makes us more willing to connect with the person that just touched us, more willing to learn from the person who just touched us, and more open to actual, you know, having a relationship with that person. And that's why in all societies, we have some way of appropriately touching each other when we actually meet. So Stoic societies like ours, we shake hands with each other. You know, Europe, they'll kiss each other on the cheek. Even the Inuits, who are fully clothed because it's so cold, will rub noses because it's the only part of skin that's actually showing. And so, you know, we've got some way of doing that appropriately so we can release oxytocin in the brain so that we can actually connect with each other. And sadly, it was happening before COVID, but since COVID, you know, nobody touches anybody anymore. Nobody even shakes hands anymore. And we need to be doing more of that. And, you know, the first thing teachers should be doing is stand at the door when your students arrive and shake everyone's hand. Or, you know, I know some teachers have different shakes and different things and everything for every student and all the rest, depending on the age of the student and all those sorts of things. Or they give them an option, you know, you high five or a handshake or, you know, fist pump or, you know, whatever they want to do. But do that because it releases the oxytocin because you're actually shaking hands, and which means you're touching each other. But it also means you look each other in the eye, right? Mm. So you actually eyeball each other, and so you can actually see what they're doing. And insisting that they do look you in the eye is really important because it actually shows that you're acknowledging that they're there and they're acknowledging that you're there and you're both humans and you want to actually interact with each other. And it's sadly a lot of kids and a lot of people now, right? You walk around the streets today and people are looking at the ground all the time. They're either looking at their phones or they're trying to ignore everybody, right? By looking at the ground, which is nuts. We're humans and you remember the old days when you get into an elevator and you actually say hello to someone when they're in, even if you didn't know them? What are you doing? We don't do that anymore. We like this the whole time. And that's really sad. So sad, because we got this loneliness epidemic, and a lot of it has to do with the fact we're not interacting with strangers anymore.
That's so interesting. And I've seen some of those clips before, particularly on social media, of the teacher standing at the door. I know, you've got that special handshake for each student and building that connection. So it's a great example, because I think you're so right. Like, and I think it's, for some teachers, it can be that, like, I think there's nothing wrong with a fist pump or a handshake or your special shake. It's a good way to go about it. Because I think when you talk about like touching students, that element of hesitation comes in, for obvious reasons. But having that, like, just that fist pump or like just a pat on the shoulder or whatever it is, that's something I think we can all do. And that eye contact as well. You're so right. When you said the elevator, then I remember, like, being in a few elevators recently. Just have your head down. Don't talk to me. Don't.
I don't want anyone to talk to me.
Don't look at me. But you're right. Like, it's, and sometimes, like, I'm a bit the same. Like, I don't feel that. I'm quite aware of what you're saying, but sometimes I think, I don't know, like, maybe we just copy what other people do. And I have to remind myself sometimes, like, when I am walking down a mall or something like that, just like look up and look around, like, to just look at people. Like,
Smile at people. Smile at people. I mean, smiles are contagious, right? You smile at someone, they automatically smile back, and they feel better then because then all this, good neurotransmitters are released in their brain, and all of a sudden you've made all these people feel better about life. Whereas we're all walking around looking mopey because no one's smiling at anyone. Yeah, and you miss out.
Absolutely.
You miss out on meeting people who might be interesting.
That's very true. So that's a great example. So I've just got one for you. One thing that when I was teaching, one thing that I was a PE teacher, so I was really trying to make that connection, because I didn't see them all the time. You'd see them once or twice a week for a lesson, but then you'd see them in the yard, of course. And one thing I used to try to do was particularly ask them. Quite a few of the kids at our school did play sports, so it was quite easy to do. But just ask them about how their sport went on the weekend to show they're interested. Is that a good way to connect with students as well?
Absolutely. You've got to understand who they are, right? Where they come from and what they're actually interested in. And also just talking about the fact that you did, right? That, talking to if they play soccer and you played soccer as a kid. I played soccer when I was a kid. Or, I never played soccer because I was pretty bad at it. So I had to do something else or whatever. You know what I mean? Like getting that connection. So they actually go, oh, you're actually a human. You're not just this person who. And I was actually at a school last week, and the maths teacher grabbed me during the morning tea. And he said that because maths teachers always have a bad rep, right? Sadly. Especially when it comes to connection and having that relationship with the students. And he said before every class, because he's a high school maths teacher, so he only sees them a couple of times a week, and they're teenagers. He discusses something that's actually going on, either in the community or in the news or whatever, before he gets into maths, right? And he said, I always discuss at every one of my classes. I spend the first 5 minutes talking about something that'd be interesting to the students, and so they can talk to me about it. And then we get into maths, and he said, and most of my students, and I spoke to one of the deputy principals, and they said, yeah, everybody wants to be in his maths class because, most kids hate maths, but they love being in his class because he makes that connection first, and then he goes into actually teaching maths. And so the actual stuff he teaches is the same as every other teacher, but the fact that he gives them that 5 minutes, and the kids respond to it, and he gets through more curriculum than the other teachers because of the fact that they respect him and they're interested in him and they like him and they want to learn from him.
That's really interesting. And I think, like, it's one of those things where it's not too hard to do either. Like, just being conscious as a teacher to, okay, I'm going to connect with the students today. I'm going to connect with the whole class. I'll get around to a few students, and over the week I'll connect with everyone and just see how they're going, share some stories about my life, how they're going in their life. And I think that's a like, it's, as I said, it's not too hard to do. It's just being aware of doing it
Yeah, I
and
think we've
doing
forgotten that teaching is a really, really human occupation,
it.
right? It's actually a really, really fundamental human occupation. I mean, we talk about prostitution being the first profession, but to be honest, it probably is being a teacher because if you think back when we were in little groups, you would have had elders within that group who would have taught everybody else about what was going on and everything. And they would have been the most respected person within the group, and they would have had all the knowledge, and they would have passed it on through stories and all the rest of it, right? Because they were connected. And so it really is a really human thing to do. But the human aspect to it is being lost because we've been handed all this curriculum and we've been told that, we're not allowed to touch students, and we're being told that, you have to be, professional and all this. But being professional is actually about connecting with them, right? Even when I work with CEOs, I talk about the fact that they've got to connect with their staff before they can actually tell them what to do, right? It doesn't matter what you're doing. We as humans need to connect first, and then we can teach, or then we can, get them to do stuff that we want them to do.
That's really interesting. I love that. And Mate, I've just got to, like, over the last 25 years of your work, what's one of the biggest misconceptions schools still have about the brain and learning? What's some of those things that you see? Maybe one or two things.
One or two things here. Well, that's a great question. I think the biggest one is that your IQ or your intelligence level is somehow already defined. It's already decided, right? We know now that your IQ just during your teen years will increase or decrease by about 15 basis points, which means that you can go from being an average student to a significantly above average student during your teen years alone. Or you can go from a significantly above average student to a average or below average student during your teen years, right? And in primary years, it's even more than that. And even in adults, we move quite a bit in our intelligence levels. And so this idea that we should be testing students and then sticking them into different streams based on those tests is flawed, is completely flawed, and it's been shown to be flawed. And a lot of countries, it's actually illegal to do it. Canada, it's illegal to actually stream students because it does so much damage to the students. Because you get a student who happens to do well in a test in, you know, grade two or grade three, gets streamed into the smart class and thinks they're smart, yeah? And so therefore they're going to do better because they think they're smart and they'll go on and be more successful. But then you get a whole bunch of other kids who you go, oh, you failed that, so you're not in the smart class. They're going to think they're dumb, so therefore they are going to end up that way, even though they have just the same potential as a kid that gets put in the smart class. And a lot of schools go, oh, but we don't label them as a smart class or the dumb class, but every kid knows which one's a smart class. And every teacher knows which class they don't want. But I think that's the biggest misconception, is that these kids are somehow already predefined to be a certain intelligence level, and it's just not true. Not true at all. So, take me for example.
Yes, that's right. Very good example. So I guess with that, if you've got I know that we talked about, like, labeling then, and it's probably not a great thing to label students if they're in the smart or not so smart category. So how do we develop those students, I guess, from the brain sense to develop them, whether they're smart already and they can maintain that and go even further, or if they maybe a little bit behind and they need to catch up a little bit? What's some strategies, or how do we, I guess, how does the brain relate to, I guess, better learning outcomes?
Yeah, so what we need to remember, again, is that they learn from those they connected with. And one of the mistakes I think made in some classrooms is that you will get teachers who will ask questions and then get kids to put up their hands. And that's the worst way to teach, right? Because what happens is the kids, the smart kids, will put up their hand because they know the answer. And then they'll be called upon to actually answer the question. The problem is that the kids that didn't know the answer will probably not like the smart kid. So Hermione Granger puts up her hand.
Yep.
The teacher asks her the answer. She gets the answer right. You don't learn anything if you get something right, right? Actually getting things correct means that you're not learning anything at all. So she didn't learn anything at all. And of course the teacher didn't learn anything because they knew the answer already. But everybody else in the class doesn't like Hermione Granger, so they don't listen and they can't learn from her because they're not actually connected with her. So all the kids that needed to actually learn from that didn't learn anything at all. Yeah? So you just wasted a couple of minutes. An alternative to doing that, because you do need to go over stuff, and is just because teachers know which kids are actually getting it, which kids aren't getting it, because they're professionals, right?
Yep.
Is just to stand at the front of the class for like 2 minutes and say a question, wait a second, and then give them the answer. Because if I ask you what color are unicorns, you automatically think of the answer, or you realize you don't know the answer. And so you can just stand in the front of the class and say, what color are unicorns? They're purple. And they've all just learned something if they didn't realize they were purple, right? What color are, you know, this? Right? And go through a whole bunch. And you can go through 20 questions in like two minutes, right? Mm. And you've all of a sudden hit all these questions. And the kids who wouldn't have listened to Miney, right, will actually be going through that process of thinking what the answer is and then, you know, realizing they got it wrong, but now having just learned something, because that's when you actually learn, when you get something wrong. So it actually works really, really well at getting that information in and reinforcing the information that you're actually been trying to teach over the last couple of weeks or
God, that's
couple of months or
interesting.
whatever it is.
Because I reckon 95% of the teachers would do that. Like ask a question, and then get people to put their hand up, and it's the same ones. Like thinking about it then, like when I go into schools and do what I do now, like I do that. And you're right. Like thinking about it now, it's the same two or three kids you put your hand up, and but that's I want to use that. I'll be Underball Primary School tomorrow in Victoria. Only 16 kids at the school, so I'm going to use that strategy straight away. And I guess just to clarify that, so if you're asking a question like what color is a unicorn, do you pause for a little bit to give them time to think and then give them the answer? Is that the strategy?
Yeah, but it's only quick, right? Straight away, you know the answer, right? If I ask you, yeah, what color are unicorns? Straight away, your brain goes, oh, it's this. Or you go, oh, I don't know that. And then the teacher gives the answer. So it's only a really brief pause because it doesn't take long. Unless you're asking a really complex question that they have to do calculations for. But that's not what this is for, right? This is just for running through a whole bunch of stuff that they've already learned or they should have already learned, but probably haven't. Because we know that, when we're learning, we forget the information really quickly, right? Because you've got that Ebbinghausen forgetting curve, which was Ebbinghausen was what, 150 years ago, and it's still actually used, which is, it 100% of the time. So right now you will remember that unicorns are purple because I just told you unicorns are purple. But probably in a week's time you will have forgotten that because there's no reason for you to remember stupid things that I say. So you've got to rehearse it, right? Which is why we used to have flashcards, which flashcards are probably the best way to actually remember things, right? Why we have flashcards and things. But when you actually are reminded of it, you go back to the top and you forget it less quickly. But you only forget it less quickly if you got it wrong. If you actually get it right, so Hermione got it right, she'll continue to forget it at the same rate. You've actually got to get it wrong to actually go back up to the top and to actually forget it less quickly. Because our brain is all about detecting when we're wrong, right? It doesn't care when we're right because we're right. It only cares when we're wrong, and then it actually starts adjusting things and changing the way our brain's set up. So they've got to be wrong. And this is a way of them sitting there and being wrong without feeling bad about the fact that they've been wrong, right? Because there's no feedback to it. Which is why I know there's people out there who run programs where they teach teachers how to do things like they have paddle pop sticks, and they give them all a paddle pop stick with a different number on it. And then they call upon one, number one and number. And again, you're embarrassing the kids who don't know the answer. Right, and then none of them are learning because they're not connected with each other, and so it doesn't actually work. It's just as bad as getting them to put their hands up. And that's a much easier way to do it, where you don't make any kid feel bad, and you actually get into it to actually learn the differences.
That's really interesting. No, thanks for sharing that. That's amazing. And I just thought of something else. So when you, for example, like I'm just thinking about what I do, and I know that other teachers do this as well. Like you might ask the students to have like a bit of a group discussion, whether that's in pairs or groups of three, and it could be like just a simple like reflection question about like have a look around the classroom at the moment, and what's maybe one or two things that you're grateful for or lucky to have in the classroom. So is that sort of like it's sort of one that everyone knows the answer to, but it's kind of, I guess, just reinforcing and reminding us of how lucky we are to have the things coming from a gratitude sense. Is that useful to do from a brain point of view to train our brain to focus on the good things and things that we're grateful for?
I mean, I do a gratitude journal, which is I do it at night, where I, write down before just before I go to sleep, three things that I'm grateful for today, and then three things that I am going to be grateful for tomorrow. So three things that are gonna that I'm hoping will happen tomorrow that I'm gonna be So I'm actually then focusing on the future, and so that is a really good thing for us to be thinking about constantly is what we're grateful for, right? I mean, it's amazing, Well, we're the first generation where most people have access to indoor plumbing, and things like that. I mean, things that we don't think about normally, right? And I mean, showers are amazing, right? And yet, if you think about it, previous generations, most people didn't actually have access to showers. Being grateful and realizing that we are, then there's ne never been a time which has been as good for us as right now. And we should remember that. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So, and one thing I know we spoke about this briefly before we hit record is just that self-talk, because I think as humans, we're wired, you know more than this than me, but we're wired to focus on the negatives because that's the way our brain is sort of like we're born, I guess. But I guess we can train our brains to focus on the good things. So if you've got a person, whether that's a young person or an adult whose brain is really hardwired to focus on those negatives, what's a way that perhaps, or strategies that we can perhaps help those people, I guess, rewire those their brains to focus on the good things?
Yeah. So one thing I'd like to clarify is that there's a misconception out there that our brains are wired up to focus on the negative.
Which that's why you're the expert, because that's what you hear.
It's been misconstrued because what our brains are hardwired to detect negative, right? So we'll actually orient to an angry face. We'll actually orient to a lion. We'll orient to danger. We'll orient to negative things. But our brains aren't wired to be constantly in a state of a negative state, right? Our brains become wired based on our experiences to whatever state that we want it to be wired at, which is why we can become very positive. And there are people, right, who are always positive, who are always thinking positive things, and all their self-talk is positive rather than negative. And there's people who are constantly negative self-talk, but that's because they've done a lot of negative self-talk, because they've been surrounded by people who do a lot of negative self-talk, versus people who do a lot of positive self-talk because they've been surrounded by people who do a lot of positive self-talk, and that's what they've done. So if you do a lot of negative self-talk, it's because of the way our brains learn is through heavy learning, which is this idea that cells that fire together wire together. And so the more you do something, the stronger those connections get. And so therefore, the more likely it is to happen. And you do a lot of self-talk because you've done a lot of self-talk. So you've got to stop yourself from doing a lot of negative self-talk. Sorry. We're always doing self-talk, but negative self-talk. And the way you do that, the only way you can really do that is not to every time you do it, then try to do positive self-talk, but to stop yourself. So as soon as you realize you're doing self-talk, the best way to do it, or the easiest, well, not the easiest way, probably the best, we'll say the best way to do it is to have a journal or to have some note-taking thing. And when you have a negative thought, stop and write in your journal positive things about yourself. Turn it around and write things. And by actually writing with pen and paper, you actually slow yourself down and you get yourself to really think about what is important to you and why you need to start thinking positively, and doing gratitude or whatever it is that you want to do in the notepad is really good. There's a great book written by Craig Semple, who was a police officer, a very senior police officer in New South Wales Police Force, and he had to be retired from the police force because of mental health issues. He was working on the cases in the motorbike gangs and homicide, like horrendous things that he actually saw and went through. And his brain was set up to constantly see negative things, right? Yep. And he went through PTSD and he had depression and tried suicide and all this stuff. And he wrote a great book called Getting Up Again. But he talks about the fact that took him years to rewire his brain so that he saw the positive things in the world rather than the negative things in the world. And he did that through this journaling, through just having a journal. And he talks about, driving down freeways and having negative thought and quickly pulling over and pulling out his journal and actually just writing down positive things. But that's what we need to be doing to change that. But we do, there is this strange misconception out in the world that our brains are wired for negative thoughts. They're not. At all. That's just the way our brains have. And one of the big problems, of course, is we're constantly being fed negative thoughts on the internet. And that's strengthening those connections, right? Constantly strengthening those connections. And that's the sad thing about kids, right? Is that they're constantly being wired up for a negative response or a negative thoughts or negative self-talk.
Absolutely. And that's why I don't watch the news, because it's like 95% negative. Like, you might hear one half decent story as a highlight at the end of just before they finish, is good news story today, and that's it. So sometimes it's just good to avoid those situations, not even watch it or look at it.
And most of it we don't need to know, right? Exactly. Most of it doesn't actually make a difference in our lives on a I know a lot of people are getting very upset about Trump at the moment. And it's like, well, it's not, it doesn't make anything difference to me every day. It's sad what he's doing, absolutely, but I don't need to be listening to it constantly.
And you find the serious stuff, and the serious stuff that you need to find out, you'll find out. Like, so yeah, I agree with that totally. Mate, mate, loving this conversation. I've just got a couple more questions. So just on that, with technology, is a massive part of students' lives. And I guess I'm not sure if there's too much, because it's quite like technology's advanced so quickly. With all this AI technology that's coming through, how is it changing our brains, and how can we work with tech rather than against it in education? Because you mentioned before about the best way, or when we're learning off a device, it's not as effective as learning from a person. So, yeah, what are some of those strategies that we can work with, like AI and technology, because it's here, but how can we utilize it for the better?
I think there's a few things we need to realize. One is that most tech companies aren't developing laptops anymore, right? They've stopped developing laptops because laptops and computers won't exist in about 5 years' time. So teaching kids how to use laptops is actually, teaching them to use something that's not going to actually be something they'll use in about 10 years' time, because voice recognition has got so good nowadays, right? And so we're all going to be using voice recognition, which means that to actually be productive in the future, you're going to have really good vocabulary, right? And really good ability to think and then speak really well, which means that people who have done probably drama and these things are going to be the most successful people, because they're going to be able to do those things really easily. So, and we here in Australia, I mean, most educators here in Australia talk about the fact that, technology is a part of kids' lives, but a lot of countries, it's not. You talk about countries like Italy, they don't have laptops and so on in schools, right? Most of the Scandinavian countries are now getting rid of all of the laptops out of the schools and putting textbooks back into schools. Places like Singapore as well have done the opposite. China's now doing the opposite. China's actually making it illegal for you to give a mobile phone to a kid who's under the age of 13, for example. Right? A lot of countries are turning around and going, hang on, this is actually harmful to these kids. And so we're going to stop doing it. And I think that's what we need to think about. If Sydney Grammar School, for example, they have laptops available in the school, but they don't have BYOD. And if the teacher needs to use the laptop for a specific task, then they have to actually book it out, and then they take it into class and they actually use it just for that thing. Otherwise, they're on pen and paper. And that's, I think, where we need to get back to, using them as a tool when we actually need to use them, and not using them as the default. And in a lot of schools, it's the default. Kids will just walk into the classroom, pull out their laptop, open it up. That we need to get away from, because they are stressful. They increase cortisol levels. They make the kids more stressed, which means they decrease the amount of dopamine, which means that they actually impact negatively on their learning when they're actually on them. Plus, most kids, well, a lot of kids are actually gaming in the classroom. They're
I was
gaming,
going
or
to say,
they're watching pornography, or they're watching social media, or they're texting with each other, right? We got rid of the phones because we knew that was bad and they were texting in the classroom. But now they've just put those apps on their laptop. So they're now still texting each other in the classroom. It's just they're on the laptop rather than the. So yeah, we need to start using it as a tool and think of it as a tool. And I think that's, I mean, one of the things that really annoys me, I was going to say a rude word, but I'll say annoys me about a lot of the technology, is that it's not been designed in a way that actually benefits us. It's been designed so it'll make a lot of money for people, right? And if you think about like social media, there's nothing social about social media. Social media is advertising, right? And you either advertise a business or a company or an event, or you're advertising yourself. And kids learning that advertising themselves is the way that they get friends and likes is really, really sad way to actually bring up kids, right? And the productivity apps make us less productive. It's been shown that we're less productive today if we're using productivity apps than if we're not using productivity apps. They don't make us productive. Even the step counters, right? If you get a step counter, you're actually more likely to put on weight than if you don't get a step counter, if you get one of those wish things, because you get to the 10,000 steps and then you stop doing it
Interesting.
yourself, so you no longer. So most of them aren't actually doing what they say they're doing. What they're doing is just making, these billionaires lots of money over in Silicon Valley, so they can buy, more rockets that look like penises and fly around.
That's right.
Like, it's just crazy. And we got to rethink that. And we got to realize what education is about and use the laptops when it's actually beneficial for the students, and then don't have them in the classroom when it's not beneficial for the students. Like, mathematics should be done on a piece of paper. There's no reason to have a laptop in a class, in a maths class. I can't imagine any time you would need it. They should be using a calculator, and they should be using paper. And there are some, like technology and stuff, where it's cool and it's good. And even in music classes, right, they can compose things and all those sorts of things. But what you want them to do is to learn how to use a musical instrument first, right, and then bring a laptop in to allow them to record that and then compose on it. Yeah.
It's really interesting. I think you make some... Yeah, really. I love a pen and paper. Like, I've got about four or five notepads that I carry around. Like, one's a journal, one's ideas, and just writing stuff down. It's such a powerful thing. And one thing that I think, just to summarize what you suggested there, Mark, is I think what you're saying is that when there's an opportunity to, or when we're learning and we can actually write it, write. And when it's research, it might be using the internet or a laptop to research. But when the opportunity, instead of like doing assignments on laptops, we should be writing. Maybe the draft, and then maybe it's, once the draft's done, then we can type it. Is that fair to say? In a summary?
Yeah. And I think we should, as teachers, we should be getting them to take photos of the drafts or whatever, or submit the drafts, right, handwritten drafts, so that we can see they've actually done it, rather than they've used AI to actually do it.
Yep.
Then you get around all those problems as well, because you've got to do all these stages first, which are all off the laptop. And you've got to submit those as well, so that we can see them, so that we know that you haven't just gone onto AI the night before and gone, do this for me, and it's done it for them, and they haven't learned anything at all, and you give them an A for it, right?
It's a tricky one, isn't the AI, like with the what it can do. Like, it's must be a challenging time for teachers and schools to work out what is theirs and what's not.
And it's really, I find it really sad, because we're spending huge amounts of money and huge amounts of resources, right, to create this thing, which we're only really creating it because we can, right? Because it's not actually beneficial, right? But, you know, creating a program that can write makes no real sense, because we as humans are actually really good at writing, right? Yeah. We're actually really good at coming up with ideas and writing. And there's a whole bunch of authors out there who love writing. So why spend all that money and resources creating something that can write? Similarly, why create something that can draw and create art, when we as humans are really good at creating art and drawing and doing those things, right? We're only artificial intelligence. Artificial actually means fake. So it's fake intelligence. And we're only doing it because tech billionaires want to prove that they can create something just as intelligent as us. But there's no other reason to really do it, because we're actually good at doing all those things. What we should be doing is putting all our resources into creating things that we're not very good at doing. And so we can get rid of doing those things that we're not good at doing, rather than creating something that's good at what we actually do. And that really frustrates me, because we're wasting huge amounts of time and resources on creating things that aren't really beneficial to us at all.
Yeah, interesting.
Natural crap, they're causing more problems.
Yep. And I guess because particularly AI it's been around for a long time, but in particular with ChatGPT and a lot of the population using it, I guess we haven't really, it's probably starting to come through now, but some of the impacts that AI and technology is going to have on whether that's learning and our brain will only come through in the next few years, I guess.
Yeah, and it's pretty scary. I mean, we know that early onset dementia. Dementia is caused because you're not using your brain, right? Because people are, and we know it's due to cognitive capacity. So people who aren't using their brain regularly are more likely to get Alzheimer's disease and so on. And early onset Alzheimer's amongst the 25 to 35 year olds has increased 400% in the last 2 years, right? So these kids are not using their brains because they're, doing all this stuff on devices and not actually thinking and not writing and not contemplating and not, discussing things with each other and so on, and not interacting. And we need to really have a good think about that, because that's literally killing them.
God, that's interesting. And just actually, I've got just one more question, Mark, just on that. Like, what's one small habit or routine that you personally use or you can recommend that does keep our brain sharp?
Yeah, this is an easy one. So the Harvard study, which has been going on for 75 years, and a huge number of people that's in this study, and cross generations and everything, and all of the analysis of all that data, which they just, the most recent papers came out about 12 months ago. They all show the one thing you can do, which will decrease the likelihood of you having Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, improve your cardiovascular system, so actually make you healthier. Improve the decreased likelihood you'll have mental health issues today, improve your IQ, so it actually makes you smarter, and decrease your stress levels, is just to sit down with someone you trust and chat to them face to face and honestly, three or four times a week.
Interesting.
All you got to do. And you'll actually increase your lifespan by 10 to 15 years. You actually live 10 to 15 years longer. So, we've got all these people who get up at 4 a.m. and do ice baths and go for 20K jogs and then slather themselves in avocado because they want to live longer. And then they have a phone in their pocket and they don't spend time with people. And it's, they're dying younger because of it. And all you need to do is just sit down with someone you trust on a regular basis. So I do, three or four times a week, I have a whole bunch of different people that I meet up with and have a coffee face to face and have a chat and shake their hand when I meet them. Or a couple of them, we're good friends and we cuddle each other before, when we meet and we sit down and we have a coffee and we have a good chat about shit that's happening so that we feel better about ourselves.
God, it's interesting you say that. And I didn't mean to do this, but I've actually made a conscious effort over the last probably one or two, 2 months to actually meet someone and have a coffee with them once a week. That's what I, and some meet someone new. So maybe someone I haven't met before, and that might be reaching out on like LinkedIn to connect with them and actually meeting up in person, or meeting with people that you know as well. But that's good. That's a good thing to know.
Schedule it in and keep doing it. It's good for it, really good for us. And we should
No,
all be doing
absolutely.
it on a regular basis.
And I guess there's just one last point on that. I guess it's a good opportunity, like in a school, just get the students, I don't know, 3 or 4 times a week for 5 or 10 minutes, just talk with each other. Like allow that time for just based on what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just chat with each other about whatever they want to chat to each other. And that's why that math teacher, right, is doing so well because he has that 5 minutes at the beginning of every class where he just chats to them about something that's going on, something that's important to all of them, and something that they can all, talk about, and has that connection. It's awesome. And it's
That's
so
it.
easy. And
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It
it's
is.
cheap. It's cheap.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. No, that's so interesting, mate. I really appreciate your time today and all those insights that you shared. And personally, I've learned a stack in our 45 or 50 minutes or so. And it's, yeah, I know a lot of people are going to get a lot of value from our conversation. So, Mark, I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you very much, Ash.